I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Francisco Cantú joined the Border Patrol in 2008. He left 4 years later. His memoir, The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border, traces his path working as a field agent patrolling two deserts to ultimately leaving the force. Cantú joined us in the studio to talk about his journey. If you can tell us a little bit about the title of the book before we actually get into what you've written. It's called The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. The Line Becomes a River, obviously this is in reference to the border between U.S. and Mexico.
Yeah, when I was trying to think about a title, I was thinking a lot about what borders we sort of accept as natural and what borders seem to be imposed. And so, you know, a river or a mountain range or something like that, it seems to be a natural border that we can maybe, you know, accept as demarcating one side from the other. And then, of course, where I'm from Arizona, the border that we have there is just this line across the desert that, you know, you can just see drawn across the landscape. You could see that in satellite imagery, or if you're down there, you climb to the top of a hill, you can just kind of see it cut across the desert. And so I wanted to sort of evoke that tension between natural borders and unnatural borders with the title. And so it came to me just by looking at a map, really.
You referenced the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in a section of your book, and that was, I believe, 170 years ago this month that the demarcation between the U.S. and Mexico was created. And you have this line, essentially, that goes from the California coast to West Texas, at which point the line becomes a river. And you also point out in the book that there's been a bit of controversy over where exactly that line lies. So a bunch of engineers got together to create these monuments to mark the lines. And it's really interesting, if people were to just go on the internet and look for some of these border markers, they're actually really fascinating and very varied.
They are. There's a photographer named David Taylor, and he has a book called Monuments. It's a, you know, coffee table-sized photography book in which he travels the entire length of the border from the Rio Grande to the coast of California. And he photographs every single border monument, sometimes on the south side, sometimes on the north side, and the scenery around it. And, of course, some of those monuments are in urban areas. Some of them are, you know, on top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere. So it's a really amazing book to kind of take a tour of the border that way. I became really fascinated with looking at the commission reports from the Boundary Commission that established those monuments across that portion of New Mexico, Arizona, and California. And there's this portion where they talk about that point where, you know, the line meets the Rio Grande. And they talk about how the river would shift its course and how silt would build up. And, you know, sometimes it would move as much as a mile. And in El Paso, where you're from and where I've lived, there was a point in, I think, the 1970s where there was a big treaty and they cemented the river into a channel in order to keep it from shifting because there was all this contested land. It used to be in Mexico. Now it's in the United States. I think that's so fascinating. It really complicates our understanding of borders as being a rigid thing.
And so now let's get to your book. The book is written in three parts. And, you know, we're not giving away any spoilers. You're a former Border Patrol agent. So the first part of the book is you sort of going on your first field duty in Arizona. The second part of the book, you are field agent to working in a desk to working back on the field again. And then the third part of the book is post-Border Patrol. So let's focus a little bit on the first part when you're a field agent. And so before getting into the field, you are an international relations major, I believe, at the university. Which university did you attend?
I went to American University in Washington, D.C.
What was it that made you want to view the border from the inside as a Border Patrol agent, as opposed to, say, maybe furthering your studies, getting a master's, or maybe getting a doctorate? Why did you feel you had to get that hands-on experience?
So I think it's important to mention that I grew up in the Southwest. My mother was a park ranger. So as a kid, I grew up very close to the desert, and because of my mother, I became sort of very intimate with it. And going away from the Southwest for school, I felt you know, very divorced from the reality of the Southwest and of the desert. So when I was studying U.S.-Mexico relations and border issues, I always felt like I was missing something. I felt like I was acquiring a lot of great book knowledge and knowledge of these, you know, facts and figures and history. But by the time I graduated, I had all of these questions, and those are some of the same questions that we're grappling with today. And I felt like in order to really understand the border, I needed to return to the Southwest. And I also felt like I needed to have closeness with that landscape in order to understand the landscape that's being traversed by these migrants. And so when I thought about it, the Border Patrol was kind of the only way to be out there day in and day out on the hottest days of the year and the coldest nights of the winter. Even though I wasn't really a law enforcement-minded person when I started looking at it, you know, I didn't want to just go out on the weekends. I didn't want to go there on a day trip. Border Patrol, like, they're kind of the only people that are out there all the time.
And so once you were out on the field, what did you experience when you first came across your first drug find? You write about this in the book.
You know, I remember it was our second day in the field, I think. We were fresh out of the Border Patrol Academy, and I think a sensor went off, and we picked up the footprints and followed them up from the border road and ended up walking maybe 3 miles or something. And it was a group of marijuana smugglers, and they kind of dumped their marijuana bundles and scattered off into the mountains way ahead of when we got there. So when we came up, there was just these backpacks. There was these bundles of marijuana and then these backpacks full of food and water and cigarettes. And I remember just sort of standing back and watching how our training agent just sort of like let everybody go loose, and people were kind of rummaging through the backpacks, smoking the cigarettes that they found, stepping on the food, you know, throwing the clothes, just like scattering the clothes on ocotillo and cactus. And at the time, you're not in a position to really do anything other than like sit back and watch. But I think, you know, years later, when I started taking things out of my journal and looking at them and thinking about this book, being kind of jarred by that in a way that I wasn't in the moment.
But why did they do that?
I don't know. I think that in the station where I worked, it's sort of out in the middle of nowhere, and there's this Wild West mentality that I think a lot of agents bring to the job. And I don't know why. I mean, it's destructive and childish, and I think that it's an issue. It's an issue that we've seen come up in the news lately. I mean, we have these videos of Border Patrol agents kicking over water bottles that have been left in the desert by humanitarian aid groups. That humanitarian aid is being set out there by people who are trying to fill, you know, a deadly void in our policy. That policy is prevention through deterrence. And that policy pushes people to cross in the most remote parts of the desert and the most deadly parts of the desert. So I think to destroy that aid that is filling this gap that's been left in our policy is really unforgivable. And I think the Border Patrol needs to be held accountable. And, you know, beyond individual agents, I think that the culture of the agency has to be changed.
And from what I read in your book, a lot of times the agents do dispose of the water in order to sort of flush people out, to make them come and find you so that you can take them back to where they can actually get food and water and, again, be deported. But you also wrote, when you came across that drug find in the backpacks, that there was no effort to pursue the smugglers because it was too much paperwork.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's all this sort of twisted logic that arises from, you know, lack of oversight, I suppose. The logic that you mentioned behind sort of destroying food and water caches is that it, like you say, that it will push people to give up and to walk towards the road or towards the village and kind of give up, and that it will sort of expedite that whole process. And in a twisted way, I think some Border Patrol agents think that, you know, that's going to save people instead of prolonging their journey, that they're going to cut things off before they get started and things will be over. But of course, that's not what happens. Of course, people are disoriented out there, and some people never make it to the road. Some people never make it to that village. And to your other question about
going after the smugglers.
Right. That policy, which again isn't a policy, it's just sort of an unspoken practice, was sort of signaled to us in this subtle way where, you know, if you apprehend a bunch of individuals along with these drugs, then that's a smuggling case, and you have to spend hours and hours writing that up, and you have to interview these people and write it up as a court case. Whereas if it's just an abandoned drug load, you don't need to write that up. That's not a case. It's not going to go before a judge. It's just kind of over and done with. So it comes from laziness.
You did encounter some immigrants who did end up off to the side of the road looking for assistance, and you share some of the encounters in your book. Could you tell us about maybe a couple of the people you encountered?
Sure. I mean, I think it's important to note, you know, we're talking about a lot of things that are very critical about Border Patrol or about policy, but the Border Patrol is also, you know, they're the first people out there that are rescuing people. And in the summertime especially, you know, the Border Patrol really turns into a rescue operation almost. And of course, you can make the argument that it's like the fire chief starting a fire and then sending his firefighters out to put it out, because, you know, you can absolutely make the argument that our policy is what's causing this crisis in the first place. But for me, you know, I was somebody who maybe naively felt that when I joined the Border Patrol, I remember making this argument to my mom that I would be able to help people. I speak Spanish. I studied abroad in Mexico. I felt like I had an understanding of where these people were coming from. I had all that knowledge from school. And I even became trained as an EMT so that I could, like, directly administer aid, you know, and my thinking was, yeah, I'll actually be saving people's lives. But I remember this one encounter where, there's this woman, this middle-aged woman, who had been left behind by her group because she couldn't keep up. And she was one of these people that sort of walked to a road and flagged down some Border Patrol agents. And I was responsible for just bringing her back to the station and sort of doing a quick medical exam of her. And she had these huge silver dollar-sized blisters on her feet. And I remember sort of bandaging her feet and cleaning her wounds and looking up at her during that and her sort of looking down at me and thanking me. You know, I had been in the Border Patrol for a while at that point. I think she even said, you know, it's very humanitarian of you or something. And I remember thinking, like, no, that's not what this is. You know, at the end of the day, I'm going to bandage your feet and then I'm putting you in a cell and you're going to be sent back to the country that you literally risked your life to flee. You could have died here and I'm sending you back to that. And so it's hard to feel good at the end of the day about that work.
But then again, she probably was also encountering the first act of human kindness since leaving her country, especially having been left behind by the people who were crossing her over.
And that's why I think this is so complex, because when I was trying all those years after I left, when I started writing this book and I was trying to make sense of the time in the Border Patrol, it's so complicated, right? Like we think of the Border Patrol as the bad guys, or these drug smugglers as the bad guys, or, you know, some people think of these migrants as the bad guys, right? They're breaking the law. And it's just never that simple. I think that if there's one thing that I hope to accomplish with this book, it's to complicate those narratives, right? And to me, you know, more than any drug bust or more than any, you know, car chase or, you know, sort of heart-pounding moment on the job, what I remember is those human interactions, those person-to-person connections. And that's what I carry with me to this day. You know, I remember that woman. I remember so many people that I encountered in the field. And those shared moments of humanity, I think, sort of rise above a lot of these arguments and sort of fly in the face of a lot of these black and white statements that we brandy about.
That's Francisco Cantú, former Border Patrol agent and author of The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. When we come back, Cantú recounts his time patrolling the El Paso sector. One side of the border, Ciudad Juárez, was called the murder capital of the world. But on the U.S. side, El Paso was considered one of the safest cities in America.
And so you're constantly confronted with, quote unquote, the reality of Juárez as a place. But you're actually not confronted by that reality. You're actually living in this strange bubble side by side.
That's coming up after this break. Stay tuned. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Today, we're talking with Francisco Cantú, author of The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. In case you just joined us, Cantú has been talking about his unusual decision to join the Border Patrol. He majored in international studies at American University, but felt he needed to really understand the border from a different perspective. He served in the Tucson sector when he joined in 2008. He was later transferred to the El Paso sector, and that's where we pick up this conversation. So there's another part in the book. Well, you go to a desk, you work a desk job for a while, and then you're transferred to the El Paso sector. And what years did you serve in the Border Patrol?
I served in the Border Patrol from 2008 until 2012.
So in El Paso, back around 1993, there was quite a lot of criminal activity as well during that time, and a lot of illegal crossings across the border. I can recall there's a highway that runs right along the border fence called the Border Highway, Paisano. And before the 1993 crackdown, there would be a lot of carjackings around there, around the university. People would leave pieces of furniture in the middle of the road so that you would have to stop, and then they would come and they would take your cars. But in 1993, the Border Patrol Chief Silvestre Reyes, who eventually went on to run for Congress and win, he set up something called Operation Hold the Line, where every 100 meters, there would be a Border Patrol agent there. And sure enough, there was a drastic decline in crossings from across the border into El Paso. But once Operation Hold the Line went into effect, all these crossings moved out into more treacherous domain. And I think that's where we started seeing such an increase in the number of deaths in very remote places in the desert. And you encountered quite a few of those as well.
Yeah, and what you've described is the policy that has come to be known as enforcement through deterrence, right? The thinking there was, if we seal off these urban areas, like at the time El Paso and San Diego were the big crossing ports, if we seal off those areas with agents and fencing, people won't risk it, right, to cross in those more dangerous areas because they're so remote, or they're so mountainous, or they're so devoid of any water. And of course, what we've seen is that that's not true at all. What we've seen is that people will endure just about any version of hell that you put before them in order to cross over to the other side, especially when it's to reunite with their family. So, you know, I think that this policy, it weaponizes the landscape. And I think that, you know, it's precipitated a humanitarian crisis that's occurring on our own soil. And I still think that we don't acknowledge that to the extent that we should in our conversation. Even as people who pay attention to news about the border, I still only see a few articles about this every year. And last year, for example, you know, we heard so much that border crossings were down, but the number of deaths actually went up. So it's becoming more deadly to cross the border, not less so. And I think that for me, somebody who's worked in those deserts, right, who's seen those people and, you know, who's encountered dead bodies, that is not abstract to me. You know, I think of the dead body that I found in the desert, and I think of the two boys that were with that man, and I think of trying to explain to those two boys, you know, they wanted to stay with the body. They wanted to come back with the body and bring the body to their village in Mexico. And I remember, you know, trying to explain to them that they couldn't, that they had to leave the body, and that, oh, you'll get in touch with the Mexican consulate, and you know, the county medical examiner will take possession of the body, and then, you know, maybe they'll repatriate that body. I mean, that's just so abstract to somebody who's dealing with the immediacy of death in that moment. And so that policy is something that we can change. And what can also change is the way that we demand from our policymakers a solution to this problem, and a way that we demand that these bodies and that these deaths be acknowledged, right? So many of these people are unidentified. We don't even know their names. We don't read obituaries about them in the paper. And I think that's unacceptable.
Francisco Cantú is author of The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. We'll continue this conversation next week. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You'll find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and it's also available for download as a podcast. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.